Well, how was everyone's day? Or morning. Yeah. Anybody stay up like all night, all through the night, working on a paper? Okay, we have a few. All right. Very good. Very good. Well, I hope it was worth it.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm just going to abandon this. I'm sorry. I'm really sad about this because I had some good pictures to show you today. They're of me. No, just kidding. Just kidding. All right. Well, it is a sad day, but that's all right. Okay, a couple of announcements before we begin. I won't delay your time any longer here. First of all, there is no chapel today. All right, there will be no chapel today because it was going to be a communion chapel, but there are too many diseases, so no chapel. Okay, so just you've got a free hour, so you can go enjoy some time studying or whatever else you might have to do, and a cup of coffee. So please get one. All right, so no chapel. Put that into your schedule. All right. And once again, just reminding you, if you haven't handed your paper in, you can hand that in at the end of class, or you have until 5 p.m., of course, and you can hand it into the office, let them know that it is for this class, Acts, and they're probably going to say, okay, who teaches that class? So you can let them know up front, Mr. Young teaches that class, okay? So it goes in my box. You have until 5 p.m. All right? Excellent. Oh, this is really disturbing me. It's like this mental block, like, my PowerPoint isn't working, but it's all right. It's all right. You know, leave it alone. Anyway, all right. Let's pray, and we'll get started this morning, okay? Father, thank you for your grace, Lord. Thank you for the way that you are working in our lives. And, Lord, the things that you're teaching us. So thank you for this group of students who comes here each Wednesday and Friday. And, Lord, who have made a commitment to serve you, to train, to learn your word better. And I pray that the passion with which they started this whole journey, Lord, would be the passion that they have today, that it would be renewed in their hearts, that I know that especially in this week and next week, it is very difficult to stay alert, to stay focused, to stay energized. But Lord, I pray that you would renew each of us with a new passion to see you, to learn your word, to grow in you, to fulfill the work that is before us in studies, in ministry toward others. And Lord, I pray that this hour would be especially another time in which you reinvigorate our hearts. And Lord, I pray that your word would be spoken clearly and effectively and that you would be glorified. We pray in your name. Amen. Okay, well, let's just jump right in. We left off in Acts 21. So in your notes, it'd be page 117. Page 118, right in that area. Okay. And I'm just gonna plug this. That's good. Alright. Let's see. Okay. So, Acts 21, end of Acts 21. What was happening? Anybody tell me? What was happening at the end of Acts 21? Okay. Where are we in Paul's life up to this point? What has been happening in his life up to Acts 21? All right, yeah, so his third and final missionary journey has taken place, and he has come back to Jerusalem. So normally, you know, he goes back up to Antioch, and that marks the end of his missionary journey. But this time, he came down to Jerusalem for Pentecost, remember, and he was going through purification process along with four other men. He's paying for their sacrifices, trying to make peace with the Jewish believers there and make sure that they understood where he stood in relation to the law and especially in relation to unity with them and so on. So in an effort to maintain unity in the body, he went through this purification process, and he's nearly at the end of it all when something drastic happens, all right? Some Jews from Asia, so the Jews that knew him from his missionary journeys, they're there for Pentecost, they're visiting in the temple, and they see him, and they have seen Trophimus in Jerusalem, and assumed that Trophimus, who was a Gentile, had come into the temple also, all right? Now this is where there would have been a cool picture up here. and you would have seen a picture of the temple with a little fence around it, all right? And that fence, you remember we talked about it before, was called a sorig, all right? That little fence was a barrier for the Gentiles. They couldn't come any closer to the temple than that fence, all right? So they assumed, wrongly so, that Paul had invited this Gentile past that fence, that that was the degree of his care for the law. Now, he didn't care for it anymore. He was teaching Jews not to give any attention to the law or to the temple or rituals related to the temple or anything like that. So much so that he would even go so far as to allow a Gentile to pass through those barriers and allow him into places that he wasn't welcome or had any right to be. Alright, that was a rumor. Alright, Luke clarifies that, and saying, look at verse 28 here in Acts 21. He says, this is the Jewish people crying out, the Jews from Asia trying to raise a ruckus. Men of Israel, help! This is the man who is teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law in this place. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place, for they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. All right, hadn't been done, but that was the rumor that was circulating, and that was a rumor that we would see, that we're going to see, would stick with Paul all through these next trials that he's going to have. All right, so this is all taking place in that great big temple complex. All of it's unfolding there, and so the Jews in Asia succeed in raising a ruckus and making a big deal, and things begin to deteriorate. All right, remember in the corner of the temple complex, there was a big structure. Does anybody remember the name of that structure in the southwest corner of the temple complex? Yes. All right, Fortress Antonia. Yes, it stood there. It was a garrison for Roman soldiers, and it overlooked the temple area. All right, it was a way of keeping an eye on the Jews and things happening there. So, as they are, as Paul and those in that area, all of this is unfolding, the soldiers likely see all of this happening and the ruckus being raised, and they alert the tribune, who goes down with 200 some soldiers and rescues Paul out of what is about to happen. All right? So we're going to pick up here, in verse 33. All right? Verse 33. Then the tribune came up and arrested him, this Paul, and ordered him to be bound with two chains. He inquired who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd were shouting one thing, some another, and as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. And when he came to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd, for the mob of the people followed, crying out, "Away with him." As Paul was about to be brought up into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" And Paul replied, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you to permit me to speak to the people." All right, let's stop there for a second. All right. A few things to learn here. This Egyptian that the Roman is asking Paul about, he's saying, you know, aren't you the guy that led these assassins up into or the people who are referred to as the assassins? They were otherwise known as the Sicarii, and they were the men, they were known as the dagger men, all right? They kept daggers in their cloaks. We're going to learn about Felix in just a short while, a governor of Judea who was in power at this time, and he utilized these men in order to carry out certain assassinations. All right. So Felix ordered the assassination of Jonathan, a high priest, around this time. All right. And this group, the Sicarii, understood from that whole move that they had a great deal of power and they could affect a great deal of political things. All right. That was already their mission. But they would go about and they would carry out surgical, I guess, assassinations in order to move power around within Roman government and Judean things. So, they had gathered a large group. There was one particular leader who rose among their ranks, claiming to be some sort of prophet, and he led about 4,000 of them, as we understand, into the wilderness, And there he was planning an attack upon Fortress Antonia. All right. Felix heard about it, and even though they were his buddies at one point in time, he decided this is my time to make my mark in Rome and make sure that they understand my degree of power. So he said, I'm going to wipe them out. So that's what he did. But the leader, the Egyptian leader that was the self-proclaimed prophet and all of this kind of stuff, he escaped. He ran away. All right. He got away, even though all the people who were following him, most of them were either killed or in prison. So he's still out there. All right. He's still at large at this time. So that's what the Tribune is asking about. He's like, aren't you that guy who stirred up a bunch of people? And now you're coming here to do it again. All right. Kind of a thing. All right. But Paul says, no, that's not who I am. And he clarifies, who he is. But notice he says a citizen of no obscure city. He doesn't qualify what that is, what city that is, but he will in a moment. All right. So now that he and the Tribune have a little bit of an understanding, let's look at verse 40. And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, right? And the Hebrew language here is likely the Aramaic language. The Hebrew dialect is what it's referring to. All right. We don't know for sure, but that's most scholars point to that fact. So you might see in your notes that he speaks in Aramaic. That's why that is there. Okay. So, go ahead and turn your page to 118 in your notes. Page 118. From here on out, we're going to see Paul move through, various phases of a trial. All right. Right now he is standing before the Jewish people. All right. And he is going to give a defense before the Jewish people. Then he is going to stand before the Jewish council, and he is going to give a defense before the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin. And then he is going to finally stand before Roman governors and ultimately stand before Caesar himself. Now, we don't have that recorded for us in Acts, but that is the way it moves and the history records. So it's a series of trials, all based on this misunderstanding and all concerning who Paul was and what he was attempting to do, what actually happened here in the temple area. That's what it's all about. But he, in the process, he becomes a political pawn useful to those through whose hands he's passing, all right, such as Felix and so on. And he is useful for their political agenda, stays in prison, and it's all part of God's plan. God hasn't lost control here. God hasn't lost his greatest missionary. In fact, he's using Paul in a very strategic way to get the gospel to the Gentiles, as he had said at the time of Paul's conversion, that he would stand before kings and proclaim the gospel. All right, that's what's going to be happening. So here in chapter 22, I'm going to stop reading. I'm going to ask you to do the reading here. As Paul is standing in front of this crowd of Jews, zealous Jews, I would like somebody to read verses 1 through 5, and then another, verses 6 through 16, and then finally another, verses 17 through 21. All right? So do I have somebody who's willing to read verses 1 to 5? All right, Anna, thank you very much. And then verses 6 to 16. All right, Dylan, sorry, if you want to read that, and then Logan, if you want to read the last section there, verses 17 to the end of the section, verse 21. All right, go ahead, Anna.
Those who were with me saw the light to be sure, but did not understand the message of one. telling you this. So the Lord says to you, get up and go to Damascus. There you will pull out all that from your offspring. But since I cannot see you with the brightness, I would like by you those who have been by you. A certain Ananias, and not by the king, who often was close to Paul, by all the Jews, who lived there, he said, the God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will, to do the right thing, and to do the for you will be a witness to all people who have lived. Now, my you do it, get up and be baptized, and wash away your sins, and all your sins.
All right, thank you. So Paul's speech is divided up into a few sections, and for most of you, hopefully all of you, this is a little bit of review. We've heard this story before. We've heard Paul's testimony before. We read about it as it was historically unfolding, okay? So, to us, it's not a new story. But note just a few things to note as we're going through this. He's born in Tarsus, but brought up in Jerusalem. All right, so he was about as devout as a Jew could possibly get. All right, he was taught at the feet of Gamaliel. All right, remember him, a member of the council, a well-known, prominent Pharisee. All right, respected by his peers, let alone the Jewish people in general. And so Paul is about as zealous as you can get. He says in his testimony, he's relating to these Jews and helping them understand that he's not one who takes lightly his Jewish heritage, nor did he in his past. And so on. So he is one of them and certainly one of prominence even among them. So in giving in that little bit, he then moves on to his life in Judaism and the time that he began to persecute the church and his previous thoughts to the church, right? That he is now a part of and representing to the Jews here. All right. What did he do? He persecuted them. And he says, if you have any questions, you can go ask the council, ask the high priest, ask any of them. They know. And they could tell you that the highest Jewish court can testify to the fact that this is who I was. This is what I did. And this was all born out of a zeal for my Jewish heritage and so on. But something happened, right? So he establishes that I was just like you. Even more so, I was among the best of you and the most zealous. Pick the most zealous person among you and I was there, all right? But something changed, all right? That's when we get to verse 6 and he recounts that the Lord himself spoke to Paul and his whole conversion, of course, takes place and so on. And that didn't upset the Jews at that point. All right. So there's a change that takes place. They could accept that. All right. And the change begins to take place. The trouble comes, though, when he comes back to Jerusalem. And there he is standing in the temple. And as things begin to unfold in the temple, he has a vision. And it's the Lord telling him, essentially, that I'm not just sending you to the Jews, but I am also sending you to the Gentiles. So how did the Jews, his audience, respond to this? Look at verse 22. Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth. What is happening here? Well, I'll tell you what's happening. All right. Exactly as God said was going to happen is unfolding. All right. In the very thing that Paul spoke to them, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly because they will not accept your testimony about me. All right. They're fulfilling exactly that. They will not accept your testimony about me. And so Paul was driven out of the city then. And at this point, he is also being driven away from his Jewish brothers. Verse 23, and as they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, you can just picture this, can't you? Like the whole chaos of it all. Now certainly there were some who were fully aware of what was going on, others not exactly sure, but there's a ruckus, so you might as well be part of it, right? But just all kinds of craziness. The tribune ordered him to be brought into the barracks, saying that he should be examined by flogging to find out why they were shouting against him like this. So in the tribune's mind, he's not sure why in the world these people are so angry. He hasn't been able to figure it out. And he didn't gain any understanding through Paul's defense to the Jewish people and so on. It's just chaos. So he says, well, we're going to move to step two, which was one of Rome's favorite tactics. Let's beat it out of him. All right, then we'll get the truth, right? No. So that's what he's planning. So he stretches them out for the whips in verse 25. And Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, is it lawful for you to flog a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned? So now he discloses what the city is of which he is a citizen. All right, is Rome. That's the non-obscure city. That's the very obvious city of which he is a citizen, not to mention heaven as well. Okay? But he pulls this card out as he is about to be flogged. This is a big deal. There's a lot of different elements. If you look into the history of Roman citizenship, there's a lot of different things that changed throughout time and what rights they had, what rights they didn't have, what things they were excluded from, and what benefits they received as a result of being a Roman citizen. Either way, there was a privilege, and one of those privileges was that a Roman citizen, especially at this time, was not to be flogged publicly, all right? Even just a mild beating. That wasn't supposed to happen. If they were guilty, sometimes they would be privately flogged, but either way, it wasn't supposed to be done in the way that the centurion or the tribune was about to have it done. This is a little bit of trouble because this kid cost a Roman soldier his job, essentially. So this was very significant. You didn't want to get on the wrong side of Rome. Verse 26, when the centurion heard this, he went to the tribune and said to him, what are you about to do? For this man is a Roman citizen. So the tribune came and said, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? Now, some have suggested, well, maybe Paul was lying. Maybe he was just using this as a way to get around the system, to work the system, right? All right, I'm a Roman citizen. Don't have my card with me. Sorry, left it at home. All right. No, that's not what's happening. He is a Roman citizen. Paul testifies of the fact that he was a citizen from birth. That is, he received it through his father and was born a citizen, which is even more revered there in Rome. The tribune says he bought it with a great sum of money. All right. Paul says, no, I was born as a citizen, which even more causes the people who are about to flog him to step back. So those who are about to examine him withdrew from him immediately, and the tribune was also afraid, for he realized that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had bound him. All right. If you impersonated a Roman citizen, all right, and if you said and claimed that citizenship and it was found out to be false, it was anything from like severe imprisonment to death. Okay. You didn't mess around with this. So Paul, we would understand, is telling the truth. There's no reason to doubt him in this situation. And so, anyway, he escaped the flogging, essentially, is what happened. But now the tribune is in a difficult spot because he can't use his favorite tactic of beating to get the truth out of him. So what is he going to do now? He still has to figure it out. So he says, you know what, I heard about this council, and I know that they're pretty good at extracting things. Maybe I can learn something from them. Look at verse 30. But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet, and he brought Paul down and set him before them. All right. Now, the council would not have liked this. At this time, Ananias is the high priest, and Ananias is known for his love for the favor of Rome. All right. So much so that he would rather sacrifice his friendship with his fellow Jews than to be out of favor with Rome. So he was not known for his integrity. He's not known for anything but being a little bit of a, I don't know, you know, basically betraying his people. Okay, that's what he was like. Look at verse 1 of chapter 23. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. Now the council is not only are they not excited about the fact that they're there to talk to Paul, due to the history that they had with Paul and so on. But it's also frustrating being ordered about by a Roman tribune, all right? They're being told that they have to get up that morning, they have to erase whatever plans they had, they have to meet in the, wherever it was, in the temple area, all right? And they had to examine Paul or at least talk with him, all right? Now, this would have been awkward because they didn't ask to talk with Paul. Paul didn't ask to talk with them. It's like somebody coming to your house and grabbing one of your friends and saying, all right, talk, you know, and I want to learn something. Like, okay, well, let's talk about something. All right. And it's even more awkward than the fact that they were not friends, but they were at one time friends who are now enemies. All right. So I don't know if you have an enemy in your life, but imagine that. Somebody we were once friends with and now you're at odds with each other and somebody, a third party brings you together and they say talk. All right. And I hope I can learn something and hopefully you'll let me know what's going on. So Paul is in a lose-lose situation. Right? There's nothing. He's before the highest court, who's in front of the Roman tribune. So he has the religious leaders who are powerful, and he has the Roman leaders who are powerful, and he has to try to prove his innocence in the middle of all of this. So he begins with just a simple statement: I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. True statement. It's totally subjective. He's just sharing his heart that this is how I have lived before God. In verse 2, and the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Totally, yeah. I mean, this guy was just without any moral integrity. Slap him on the mouth, you know. All right. So they strike Paul on the mouth, and he responds, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law you order me to be struck? Verse 4, those who stood by said, would you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I did not know, brothers, that he was a high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now, there's a lot of debate as to what exactly transpired here. Did Paul not know that this was a high priest because it was an informal meeting and the high priest was still in his pajamas, not wearing his normal getup? Is it because he wasn't seated in his normal seat? Or was he saying that he wasn't acting at all like a high priest, and that's why I didn't recognize him? I don't know. But either way, Paul responds by saying, I have reverence for the, essentially, I have reverence for the office, and this person is not acting like they should in regard to this office, and so I acknowledge the law and that I should revere this office and so on, and so he admits to that, but holds fast to the fact that this man did something that is contrary to the law, that is hypocritical, which is the idea of the whitewashed wall, all right? It's like a dirty, nasty wall that has just been painted to look better than it is, but the grime is still back there, all right? Ananias was a hypocrite of hypocrites in the eyes of the Jews. In fact, in 66 AD, when the Jewish revolt against Rome began, Ananias fled because he had ties with Rome, and he cared so much about those ties with Rome that the Jews immediately viewed him as an enemy. This is the high priest, all right? And so he was not only abusing his office, but he was in every way a hypocrite. And ultimately, what Paul spoke of him, God is going to strike you, it came about indeed, because Ananias left. He went and hid in one of Herod's aqueducts and so on. He was found and killed by some of the Jewish zealots who found him. Okay? Continuing on here. All right? So Paul is at a point where he realizes that this is a pretty hopeless situation. And he makes a really smart move here. I love this, what he decides to do. You can kind of see him stepping back after this very awkward situation has unfolded now. All right? He's just yelled at the high priest. I gotten in trouble for it after being slapped by somebody for, you know, just because the high priest said so. So it's a very, very awkward situation. So what is Paul going to do? Look at verse 6. Now when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. All right. Now, the Pharisees really highly esteemed their club of the Pharisees, the Pharisee club. All right. And then there was the Sadducee club, and they really esteemed themselves as being part of the Sadducee club. And they held to different beliefs and so on. But it didn't matter what other differences you had. If you were a Pharisee, All right. If you were part of the Pharisee Club, even if you were an ex-member like Paul was, right? Apparently, there were still some very important ties to be recognized. Well, he probably still has his Pharisee Club card, you know, and all of that, you know? And so he says to them, it is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And this got their attention. Because the Pharisees and the Sadducees differed in this way. Let's continue reading. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit. All right? So this is a really entrenched issue here, deeply entrenched issue, a divide between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So Paul knows that he's not going to get sympathy on either side for being a proponent of the church and proclaiming the gospel and so on. But he knows he can get a statement to the tribune, at least from one of these groups within the council, showing that he is innocent. So he appeals essentially to the Pharisees, and the Pharisees and the Sadducees start squabbling and fighting over the things that they normally do, and the yelling ensues, and it gets a little bit violent and all of that. Look at verse 9. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply. We find nothing wrong with this man. All right? It's important that we understand the role of the scribes here. They were the interpreters of the law, the lawyers of that time. All right? And so they are making a pronouncement as to his situation, and they're saying, look, Paul's innocent. So that is what the Roman tribune is hearing, that he is innocent. So other than that, he just hears chaos. We find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from them by force and bring them into the barracks. So the tribune hasn't learned a lot, except the Jewish people are kind of out of control on this whole situation. And Paul has been established and pronounced, at least in this chaotic moment, shown that he's guiltless, but that a lot of people have a lot of bad attitudes and very strong feelings about things that didn't make any sense to the tribune. So the tribune goes away still without a clear answer as to why Paul should be in prison and why he should be bound. But he doesn't want to just release him because Paul is killed, and especially now, could be killed, especially now because Paul is a Roman citizen. He knows that. And if for a tribune to release a Roman citizen out in a dangerous place, and that for that Roman citizen to be killed by the hands of Jews, that would be a black mark on his resume. And so now he's even more intent on protecting Paul and so on. But meanwhile, what's happening in Paul's mind in the midst of all of this? He's there in the middle of all of this. He hasn't done anything wrong. He came into the temple to try to make peace with the Jewish believers and so on, and it backfired, and it was just so many things have been said to him that are untrue. And then Rome got involved, and now he is in the clutches of the most powerful nation on earth, and everything seems a little bit hopeless. Look at verse 11. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Take courage. For as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome." I love this verse inserted here. You know why? Because it shows us that God is not just aware of what is going on in Paul's life, but that he is concerned and involved in what is going on in Paul's life. Not only that, but to add to that, he is sovereign over the greatest nation on earth in order to use them to affect the protective channel of his messenger to go even to the highest place in Rome. How would you get an appointment with Caesar? Well, you could get an appointment with Caesar a couple of ways. One, you had to be really, really liked by Caesar, and that's pretty hard to do, especially considering that it's Nero, and he was so fickle that he just killed off some of his family because he felt like it, okay? So that was a tough way to get to him. You could do something really, really bad, and maybe get an audience with Caesar if you weren't killed along the way. Or God could get you an audience with Caesar in protective custody, where you would end up staying in Herod's praetorium and palace and all of that while imprisoned and receive even the benefits that Rome had to offer in the meantime. Still a difficult place for Paul. And one in which he likely did not understand how God was using this and so on. He could see that he had a mission in mind in the midst of it, but Remember, the story hadn't been written yet. And so Paul is still wondering how this is. He knows that trouble is awaiting him. He knows that he is likely going to meet his death through this whole process. But he doesn't know when, doesn't know where, doesn't know how. And so this comes as encouragement. The Lord says, I'm going to send you to Rome, just as you have testified in Jerusalem, so you're going to do in Rome. Verse 12, when it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat or drink till they had killed Paul. All right, very, very bad idea. I'll just say at the outset, never, never, never make a vow that is linked with the food that you need to sustain your life. Okay, don't do it. All right, that's the major lesson here. No, just kidding. All right, but that, you can see the foolishness at the outset. All right, we're not going to eat or drink until we have killed Paul. All right, they're resolved. That's what we learn about these guys. They're resolved. They hate Paul so much, we're going to kill him. Verse 13, there were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, and we are ready to kill him before he comes near. So they've got a plan. They've got it all laid out. And they said, you know what? We are so resolved on this issue, we're not even going to eat, even though my wife just made my favorite potato salad. I'm not going to touch it because we're going to accomplish this first. Verse 16. Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. So Paul apparently had a sister and had a nephew, and he overhears apparently a young man anywhere from between 10 years old, 17 years old, somewhere in there is all we know. It's most exact we could be. But inference suggests that he was among those younger years, maybe like 10, 11, somewhere in there. Verse 17, Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him. So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked to bring this young man to you, as he has something to tell you. The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, what is it that you have to tell me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat or drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, tell no one that you have informed me about these things. So the Lord sets up a child, a young man, in the midst of all of this, as a spy. All right? So these guys' plans, these 40 men who are resolved to kill Paul, have their plans unraveled by a very small person. Okay? It's a little bit humiliating. Look at verse 23. Then he called two of the centurions. So this is totally Roman style. All right? How many guys are there? 40. Good. All right. We'll get together 470. All right? They're just going to blow, they're prepared for everything, essentially. All right? We're going to make sure this is a show of force here. We don't mess around. And we certainly aren't going to tolerate Jewish rebellion and where they're using us as their pawn. So we'll show them. These guys are going to be hungry. All right? That's the idea. All right? Then he called two of the centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen and go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. We're going to make this miserable for these guys if they're really going to try to kill Paul. We're going to go in the middle of the night and they're going to have to deal with 470, so two centurions, right, each bringing their soldiers with them. 270, yes. Did I say 470? Okay, sorry. All right, 270 with their spearmen and so on in the middle of the night. Also, provide mounts for Paul to ride on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. All right? So, they all get together, and Paul's riding on his horse with 70 spearmen around him and with 200 foot soldiers around them. And they go out, and it's like 60-some miles to Caesarea, all right? But even if these guys are going to get there, all right, they're already hungry. We don't know how long it's been since they had food. But if they were going to fulfill this, this is going to be really difficult to go those near 70 miles to accomplish this. So the Tribune sent a letter to Felix and said the following: Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving of death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there was a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. All right? So if the council was already frustrated with the Roman tribune bossing them around, all right, he says, I'm sending Paul, by the way. I heard about your little plan. I'm sending him to Caesarea, and you have to go there as well. So get ready, pack your bags. You got to go testify before Felix. So they're really frustrated now, all right? Being bossed around like that. Verse 31. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. All right, so this would have been about 40 miles from Jerusalem. So still quite a trek. After those foot soldiers went those 40 miles, they turned around and went back. But some of the rest continued on with Paul to Caesarea. And on the next day, returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. Verse 33. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he had learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. All right. So Paul, and there were some really cool pictures of this as well. But Paul is in Caesarea. Herod's praetorium was essentially his palace. It was a great big palace, and it was built by Herod the Great, so you know it's extravagant. All right. But that's where he was kept. That's where he was kept. He was kept in this was the one time he was in prison, and it was actually probably comfortable. All right. But this was unusual for Paul. So he is kept there, and Felix is going to hear his case. Felix is the governor of Judea at this time. All right. So remember Herod Agrippa and his whole thing. He had been the king of Judea. After him, Rome said enough is enough with these half-Jewish kings. We're going to just install our own governors. Not that they were any better. In fact, Felix was among some of the worst of them, described as having the power of a king, but the appetite and the instincts of a slave. All right. So he really had nothing of honor in him. He was once a slave at one point in time. He was freed. And then he and his brother both went into politics and made a great success. His brother worked for Nero, is kind of like the CFO of Rome, all right, had a very high place in the treasury, and that comes into play later on in Felix's life in a way that protected him. So Felix had this idea and lived in this way, ruled in this way, that he could do pretty much whatever he wanted, however he wanted to, and he could get away with it. And it worked for quite a while until his reign ended and Festus came in just a couple of years after Paul's trial here takes place. Let's look at verse 1 of chapter 24. And after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. They laid before the governor their case against Paul, and when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, all right, so the high priest come down, and the high priest comes down. He comes down with a few people, and he's got a special spokesman, a guy who can just lay it on thick and knows how to do it right. All right, this guy is an expert in flattery. Let's read in verse 2. As Tertullus is beginning, he says, since through you, speaking to Felix, we enjoy much peace, and since your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation, in every way and everywhere, we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. All right, so he really lays it out here. We really like you, Felix. You're a wonderful man. Everything you do is wonderful. Everybody knows it. I know it. You know it. We all know it. All right. And then he says, we're just going to take a few minutes of your time. And he does. He keeps it brief. This guy is skilled in what he's doing. All right? He knows how to handle these Roman guys. But to detain you no further, verse 4, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. For we have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots among the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Now this is important. Notice he describes Paul and those who follow in the same way as a sect, all right? A group that was technically not allowed in Rome, all right? You had to have your religion approved by Rome, all right? Rome was familiar with the group of the church called the Way, all right? And Felix, as we'll learn in a minute, was also familiar with this group. And they were at least accepted by Rome, not encouraged by Rome, but accepted by Rome at this point in time. But Tertullus is trying to undermine that and show that that this is actually illegal, that he has no respect for the Jews. Paul has no respect for the Jews, and he has no respect for Rome. He's just no good. He even tried to profane the temple, verse 6, but we seized him. Verse 8. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him everything of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the charge, so they're sitting back there and they say, yeah, ditto. Alright, they're agreeing with this guy on what he has said. Yes, question in the back. I'm not exactly sure. Yeah, so some of the, right. Good question. What version do you have? Okay, yeah. All right, good question. I'll look into that a little bit more as to what manuscripts and so on, but I think what was added is we would have judged him according to our law. I think that was the bit that was added. So, good question. Okay. I will get back to you on that, Logan. Continuing on here in just the last minute that we have, or two. So after Tertullus has finished his little accusation, and the Jews agree, and so on, verse 10, and then when the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied. I love Paul's response. He's simple, he's straightforward, he's exactly as he should be. Knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. So Felix had been a governor of this region for 10 years at the time that Paul is speaking, or from what we understand. All right? So Paul, without any flattery, without any big charade, simply says, I know that you know this nation enough and this area well enough to make an accurate decision, a sound decision. All right? And leaves it at that. Verse 11, you can verify that it is no more than 12 days since I went to worship in Jerusalem, and they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd either in the temple or in the synagogues or in the city. Neither can they prove to you that what they now bring up against me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God which these men themselves accept. There will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust, so I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple without any crowd or tumult. But some Jews from Asia, they ought to be here before you and to make an accusation, should they have anything to say against me. Or else, let these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council. Other than this one thing that I cried out while standing among them, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you this day. So Paul says a few things here. He says, number one, I wasn't in Jerusalem long enough to even stir up any trouble. I was there for a very brief time, and you can ask anybody. Look in the temple, look in the synagogue, look in the whole city. I wasn't stirring up trouble. I was found in the temple, purified, doing things according to the law. I have no... There's nothing according to Judaic law by which they can accuse me except for this one thing, that I stand before them with respect to resurrection from the dead. And so if you're going to find anything on which they powerfully disagree, that's what it's going to be. But I am innocent before Rome. I am innocent before the Jewish law and all of that. I was doing things according to Jewish law. I was doing things according to Roman law. And I stand unjustly accused before you. And this is where Paul kind of stopped, and that's where I'm going to have to stop for today. I hope you have a great weekend. Hope it's a great time at the man feast and the women's banquet. I'll see you again on Wednesday.